Hello and welcome back to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs here at Princeton University. This is my colleague and co-host, Sam.
Sam Wong, professor of neuroscience and molecular biology, also founder of the Princeton Election Consortium.
So today is a special episode of Politics and Polls. We're recording this episode in front of a live audience here at Social Media Day at Princeton University. And it's a perfect topic to discuss. Social media has now become an integral part of American politics, of the things we talk about, the things we study. It was once the realm of young people and mavericks who like to share silly videos or tweet out some funny statements, but now social media is pretty serious business. On the day we record this, James Comey, the former FBI director, released his book about his time in the administration, and the president's first response was to tweet out a series of statements. I can read a bit. James Comey is a proven leaker and liar. Virtually everyone in Washington thought he should be fired for the terrible job he did until he was, in fact, fired. He leaked classified, in caps, information, which he should be prosecuted. He lied to Congress under oath. He's a weak, untruthful slimeball who is, as time has proven, a terrible director of the FBI.
Donald Trump is on Twitter.
Yeah. Facebook. Facebook is now also, and other social media sites, serious way in which communication happens. We're now learning during the election of 2016, it was infiltrated with all sorts of news stories. And so social media and the world of politics go hand in hand. And I don't think we're quite aware what this all adds up to, what exactly it's doing and where this is all going. Is it good or bad for our democracy? How can it be used in good ways? And what are some of the dangers that we have? So I thought today we could talk about this a little bit. And one of the things people often talk about with Twitter, I'm curious, is they compare it to the fireside chat. So they'll say, there's been many moments when presidents and other politicians find new ways to communicate directly to the people. FDR did this with radio, Kennedy to some extent, John F. Kennedy did it with television, and there are moments of innovation like that. But Twitter seems different to me in that there is a total lack of control between the statement that a president makes and what people read. It's unedited. It's unscripted, and it's almost instantaneous in a way that those old means weren't. And it seems to me that's where the concern comes, and that's where the danger comes.
How different is that really, though? I mean, if you think about, like, in the 1930s, there'd be these demagogic radio hosts like Father Coughlin in the 1930s, who just, like, you had this really pretty virulent nativist message. And that went out on broadcast radio. When was that, the 1930s, I think?
Yeah, 1930s.
And millions, tens of millions of people would listen to that.
Yeah.
So what's the difference compared to that?
Comes from the Oval Office. So okay. Coughlin, for example, didn't have access. Not only do we not have nuclear weapons, but he didn't have access to them if we did.
Do we have an estimate of about what fraction of people supported Coughlin or, let's say, Joe McCarthy, people who were, you know, marginalized in those times?
I'm sure we could find out.
Okay, well, let's just hypothetically, yeah. Let's say data-less commentary.
Data-less, right.
Hello, I have sunk. So, like, let's say 20% of people are supporters of Coughlin. So one key element here is that politics has gotten polarized and political parties are weaker. So the technology's gotten quicker, and there's direct communication between people, this narrowcasting thing where if I'm really interested in cats and you're interested in cats, I can send you cat videos or whatever. I can send you things about, like, Hillary Clinton and Benghazi, whatever it might be. So there's the narrowcasting. But there's also the fact that this whole thing got leveraged. So the political parties, this is in your domain, obviously, where the national political parties have gotten weak. And so as the fraction of the population that supports a political party goes well below 50%, down to 40%, 30%, once you get to the point where 30% of the population supports a major political party, then it's possible for someone who gets the support of half of that or even less to hijack it. So imagine if Father Coughlin or, you know, Joe McCarthy or what have you was able to take that 10 to 15% support in the population and turn that into a major party nomination. So it feels to me like the weakening of parties is a thing that works with the technology, and those two things work together.
The weakening of parties and the strengthening of partisanship.
Though. Yeah.
I mean, I don't think McCarthy had that much of a hold. But imagine if he did. I mean, imagine if when Joe McCarthy was in the Senate and he was going after alleged communists, if he had a tool like Twitter available to him.
Right, he could send his message out immediately. So these things get amplified. So there's reach and there's speed, right? So like if the President of the United States at this moment had some thought, it would appear on our handhelds during, like, you know, whatever, a second later.
Someone asked me, this is kind of interesting, a student, I spoke to a group of students the other week in Georgia, the University of Georgia, and one of them asked me if when the next president is in office, regardless of who they are, will the public expect not only that they use Twitter, but that whatever you think of President Trump, that they will now expect this kind of real, kind of raw look at the President of the United States, to hear directly from him or her what they're thinking in real time. Has this now become a new expectation, and presidents can't really get away without doing it? They might do it in a more refined way, but that it was a good question. Is this the new normal now?
They're not going to do it in a less refined way.
Yeah, well, you could imagine. Right. You could imagine. You shouldn't say that. You might be eating a bug.
Thanks.
But yeah.
Six and a half minutes till that joke came out. All right, okay, keep on going.
What do you think of that? Do you think this is now permanent?
Right, so do voters expect that kind of thing? So in the sense that Franklin Roosevelt got big on radio, people started to expect to hear his voice, then we have televised debates. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the thing is, Barack Obama used Twitter as well, and his messages also got viral. He has, I think, if I remember correctly, he has substantially more followers than Donald Trump.
Yeah.
And so that was already there. The things that are different now are that the emotional heat of the content of the tweets has gone up. I think that probably President Obama's account was often used for official messages where he, you know, maybe sometimes he'd send a tweet himself, but there'd be other people who sent things for him. At this point, now the balance seems to be, you know, looks like if you do the analytics, it looks like maybe about 2/3 of Trump's tweets are his own, and then 1/3 are people in his press shop who might say something.
How do they know that?
You can trace these sorts of things. So for instance, at one point, you could trace it using the type of device that was used to send it. So if it was sent by iPhone or by Android, then at one point, I think the iPhone tweets were from Trump and the Android were from other people. Now you can like do basically word analysis of the tweets or emotional content analysis, and there's a strong relationship where the really, let's put it nicely, the really disinhibited tweets are all from one device, and the ones that appear to look like political messages that were thought of by a staff member were on the other device. And so that was a thing that was done then. They may have cleaned that up since then. It might be harder to detect tweeter identity now. But that was definitely the case early in the campaign. But it's become more refined because he's got people working for him doing this.
And the other thing that's really interesting, I'd say, is how it affects the news. And I mean, this is something I notice when I'm on the news, that it really has become, and I don't know how much you can separate Trump from this, but the Twitter feed now often will shape a lot of what the news discussion is about. And there's always people who say you should ignore the tweets. And it's pretty hard. I mean, it's pretty hard. And it's interesting. I think it's now, I mean, this is one of the things that President Trump has figured out. I mean, he really has, in my opinion, a very good feel of how the media works. Social media, television, and he has a very almost instinctive ability to get himself in the conversation. Again, for better or worse, but he can do it. And I think the social media is now a way to get into the conversation more than spokespeople, more than press statements. And it has a really profound effect. It can shape 24 hours of discussion easily.
It can shape discussion, but how much of that shapes actual policy? So for example, if we have some tweet leading to some agitation over Scott Pruitt or North Korea or whatever it might be, and then that's a 24-hour cycle of news coverage where people are running off after the shiny object, where the shiny object is the tweet, that appears to be important. Okay, but the actually important thing might be environmental policy, or it might be whether there's mobilization of military force in the Pacific Ocean. Aren't those the real things?
Might be. I mean, it might be, but like when the repeal and replace legislation was being moved, so you can look at it and say it never had a shot, and in the end, the opposition was too strong. But you'll remember he tweeted a lot during that, and he kept getting people angry. He kept getting Republicans all tied up in knots about what was happening. There was probably a correlation between the failure of that legislation ultimately and some of his own tweet missteps.
But I would say, but think about social media as being any other kind of technology where it amplifies the effects of what's going on. So previously it took a day for a fireside chat to percolate into the, you know, the populace.
Yeah.
It would take a few days for it to get back or weeks to build that up. And so now that whole thing gets amplified 100 times, 1,000 times.
Yeah.
You know, now our mental processes have not been accelerated 100 times or 1,000 times. We, with our little puny primate brains, think we're so clever, but we can barely plan, you know, whatever, a week ahead or a day ahead. And now there are these things that are happening. And the difficulty is, I think it creates pressure on people in the news media to be able to think and filter out. And I think that that's actually an adaptive response that has to happen. I mean, to put it bluntly, if we're going to survive as a civilized society, I think it would be a good idea to have self-control and look at a piece of information and say, how much do I want to amplify this thing? And I think that's tough, because if something pops up and it's the President of the United States, and holy cow, he just called him Lion Comey or whatever he says, you know.
Yeah, Lion Comey. That's the website of the RNC.
I don't know how I guessed that, yeah. But all right.
There's actually a website.
So
to that effect, let's stay on Comey for a second, or the investigation. There was a poll out yesterday. I don't follow the polls as much as you, but even though national support for the investigation remains pretty strong for Mueller, and he has more credibility than the president in the minds of many people, the number, I guess it's like 54% of Republicans now believe that Mueller and his investigation is unfair. And a lot of that has been done through Twitter. I mean, the campaign against the investigation, the president's principal weapon has been that. So even there's a real effect that would, you know, if he solidifies that among Republicans, he's in good shape.
But this is not very different from the message machine through right-wing outlets like Fox News that have a very clear message that they're going after. And it's basically like that, except now at some level, the opinion leaders at Fox News and Donald Trump are sort of conveying the same message. And usually, I think the real change here is that we're used to being governed by people who are not message people. As much as we say that message is politics, the people who are running agencies and so on are in fact engaged in the nuts and bolts of actual governance. And if you look at Donald Trump's calendar, he's got whatever, presidential special time or whatever it might be till noon. He's clearly sitting around watching TV. He's clearly not actually engaged in the business of governing. He's sitting around watching Fox and Friends and then getting out his thumbs and and doing that.
Yeah.
Right. So it's the same kind of thing. It's this weird phenomenon in which the news outlet that we think of as being separate from the government and he are the same thing at this point. Like, he's basically a Fox News viewer come to life and turned elevated to the presidency.
That's right. Let's shift gears. So let's get away from President Trump for a little while. Unless he tweets as we're speaking.
What are we going to do with the rest of the time?
But the other realm in which this all matters is in the electorate. And I'm going to go back. I had this great conversation in Georgia because the students just had terrific questions. And the other question, I was talking with the students about polarization, our standard topic, and how much of an effect it has on the electorate. And one of them raised the question about, doesn't Twitter actually seem to offer now paths for new constituencies in either party to gain a voice? And so it's not simply that...
Like it's a leveler and a democratizer?
Not a leveler, but so, you know, one way to look at it is we have polarization. Twitter, Facebook plays into that. You send the cat video to the Republicans, you send the dog video to the Democrats or vice versa, right? Fuels their pre-existing conceptions. But this student was talking about Parkland, for example, and the student movement, which is a constituency, he said, that's not heard, and that Twitter has actually offered a way for students and supporters to make themselves part of the political debate. Obviously, Black Lives Matters is another example, and so on and so on. And I don't know, I mean, do you think there's anything to that? I mean, might it have an effect ultimately on breaking some of the polarization by changing the internal life of the parties? Or is that simply too naive?
Everybody gets amplified by social media.
Yeah.
And if you're one person, you think that you got amplified a lot if you reach 50 people. And if you are a television star like Donald Trump, then you get amplified 50-fold by having a Twitter account. So everybody gets a 50, let's say a 50-fold bonus in audience and a 50-fold speed improvement. And if you're like one person at a high school, then you think that's great. But that just amplifies everything. It just makes the whole thing, it just creates a feedback in the system where it's like a car or it's like an assault weapon. It's this thing that amplifies everybody. So does it create a situation where some popular movement can become big? I don't know. It certainly is an amplifier of hot emotions. And so if you look after the Parkland shooting, emotions where you don't have time to reflect, where you just have to react reflexively and say, oh my God, look what happened there, and you retweet it or what have you. Those non-reflective responses get amplified the most easily, right? So like if you look at evidence that that the ideas that carry the most emotional content are the ones that go the most viral.
Yeah.
Like, how do we feel as a society about social media that amplifies the least thoughtful responses or the most reflective responses? Sometimes it comes from the heart, and maybe we're really interested in David Hogg or whoever from Parkland High School, from the Parkland school system, right? So maybe that's going to be the thing that gets amplified. Or maybe it's somebody who's going to want to, I don't know, beat up on Mexican people. And so everything gets amplified, and everything gets sped up to the point where we can't think.
Yeah, but that's true of any kind of era. And emotion can be really good in politics.
Okay, but I just want, push back just a little bit more. So from a historical perspective, it is always the case that technology amplifies opinion. So one could say from a historical perspective, well, we've been here before. But at some point, that turns into something that reaches the speed limit of our mental processes. And so it may be the case that it kind of sounds...
What is our speed limit? I mean, what does that mean?
What I mean is like if you have like, a minute to think about things.
Yeah.
Like, okay, let's see. So if you have 10 hours to think about a thing and that gets reduced to 10 minutes. Yeah, okay, you still have 10 minutes to think. 10 minutes down to 10 seconds, that's a lot less time. And so what I mean by that is that it may be that it just sounds like the same thing, but at some point quantity makes its own quality. And if our qualitative mental processes go back from think about our colleague Danny Kahneman and System 1 and System 2 thinking. I mean, that's just a well-known concept that's entered into the intellectual conversation of the United States. Just the idea that your thoughts are no longer able to engage critically. You can't look at the news and say, well, what would I think if Barack Obama said that? Or what would I think if that were said about some other race? Or what would I think if I were just thinking about law enforcement generally? We don't have time to engage in that kind of critical thinking. And, we need time. And I don't know what the answer is to the exact amount of time, but I know that there's much less of it now with social media. And the other thing is just think about the structure of these media. Like, why is it that, there's a joke that Facebook is a medium for losing your existing friends, and Twitter is a medium for making new enemies. And so what is it about these different kinds of media that amplifies that? And if you look at that, there are rules that are baked in that we don't even think about it, right? Like, if you look at what people over here at Princeton at the Center for Information Technology Policy, like people at CITP do, they're very interested in how technology shapes, who we are. And so if we have Twitter, which is, if you stop and think about it, Twitter is basically blogging with a very hard character limit. Like, that's what Twitter is. Mm-hmm. Okay, except it's blogging, plus it's got an element of being forced on the audience. And so it's sort of microblogging with push. And so think of it as a really aggressive RSS feed to think about a previous technology. And furthermore, think about it where it's got a response function, and there is no editing to the response function. Okay, now I run a blog, the Princeton Election Consortium, and I can tell you that I have moderation on that cranked way down. If people don't make an intellectually original point, they're out. And so it's not just, they don't have to just be polite. Mm-hmm. They actually have to say something that makes me think, oh, okay, well, I didn't think of that or what have you. And so like I really crank it down like that, and I've sometimes been accused of cranking it down too far. But one consequence of that is the conversations there are pretty civil, and I learn a lot by reading those. Reddit is less moderated, and so Reddit is more mean. 4chan, right? So there are these non-moderated media where it's either non-moderated or it's moderated by the community members. Twitter is non-moderated, and so any old dog can get onto Twitter and like say poo-poo to the person tweeting.
No, they can. I mean, the underside of Twitter is very apparent, and the underside of that kind of not thoughtless communication, but not thought through communication and quick, instantaneous responses can be very dangerous, and it leads to really, I've seen this, I've been part of it, where it just undermines the dialogue. But there is something to it, and I mean, we have a nostalgia of earlier periods of how much civil discourse there was, even on the good things. So a lot of the civil rights movement in the 60s was really emotional, or the anti-war movement. It was about, you know, from students just hearing about what was happening to another student on a campus and getting out and marching. It was about hearing a story that you saw in the news or read about from the war, or hearing about something in your family, and getting out and protesting. It was raw emotion, it was quick. Studies of civil rights shows it was often informal social networks that spread it. And this is, in some ways, it's not so new. Okay, but it's just through this tool that we're doing.
But it depends on the mediation. So the civil rights movement had leaders.
Yeah.
And so some of these raw emotions percolated up and then hit the leaders, and the leaders did something with it. So if you look back, you know, one of our previous guests on the podcast, Eric Schickler, talked about how the Democratic Party changed. The labor movement got interested in civil rights, and that percolated up from the rank and file. And that got mediated through the labor leaders, and it got, I'm changing the subject a bit, but it gets mediated through leaders. And so sometimes it gets mediated through leaders, sometimes not. So an example of social media kind of not mediating it, I remember shortly after the change in administration, there was that ban on immigration from Muslim countries.
Yep.
I was abroad at the time. Mm-hmm. And just this seemingly
just
natural, organic eruption of anger at keeping out one set of immigrants because of their faith, mm-hmm. right? That was a pretty natural migration to the airports. I guess Michael Moore was probably the one who triggered it, because he said something about going to the airports, if I remember correctly.
But he
lit some tinder, and it took off, and people. So that's an example of like it kind of a leader says something, and then the fire builds, and it runs away. But I guess what I'm getting at is that in previous times, there was the opportunity for there to be an intermediary force to moderate it, to shape it, and so on. And I think one issue here is that there's this what media people call disintermediation. Trump says a thing, I hear it, and there's nothing between Trump and me.
Yeah.
Right? And that disintermediation.
Very old-fashioned on this. I mean, and not in a bad way, but the notion of intermediary institutions in American society and the value. That's an old argument. We just talked to the author of the book on democracy, Breakdown, you remember?
Democracy, how democracy dies.
Yeah, and one of his arguments, him and his co-author, is that democratic norms and institutions are breaking down, not through coups, but slowly deteriorating. And one of the arguments...
That was Levinsky. Yeah.
Levinsky. One of the arguments is that these intermediary institutions, in some ways, have gone away. So in the 1950s and 60s, when we selected who was going to run for each party as president, party bosses still had a lot of sway. Party conventions mattered. It was a check and some kind of filter, whereas he argues now we did away with that, and so we have a much more rambunctious, wide-open primary system, which is questionable. That's the way he sees it. And that was a familiar argument, that you needed these institutions in between the leaders and the people to filter some of this, to direct it. But it was always a point of controversy. Even with back to civil rights, there were many activists who didn't like, they said the leaders were too cautious. The leaders didn't push hard enough.
But
so it's interesting. I mean, it's an old debate.
So
without, I have no answer.
Broadly speaking, the rules for choosing a presidential candidate have gotten largely more egalitarian and democratic on both sides, mm-hmm. for both Republicans and Democrats. And so people may complain about the 2016 process on either side of the aisle, but actually, for instance, the Democratic Party's primary process was the closest to being a true democratic process that it's been possibly ever, right? And so there's that, but that's partly in response to something that's not just political. The big phenomenon, I think, is distrust in institutions. Teachers are less trusted, members of the clergy less trusted, members of law enforcement less trusted, doctors, lawyers, whoever, political leaders. So it's not just political leaders, but if you look at survey data, there's survey data spanning several decades by social scientists showing that there's this general decline in trust in institutions with a few exceptions. I think the military is an exception. I've forgotten what the other exception is, but the military is one of the exceptions. And so so what do we have? More efficient communication, loss of trust in institutions, where you might like to be, if you're on CNN, you might like to be Walter Cronkite and say, look, I say this and it's true, but immediately there's this force of people who say, you're just part of the mainstream media and I don't necessarily believe you. I've done my research, I've done a web search, and I've seen Hillary Clinton kissing I've seen Hillary Clinton kissing a cat, and you can't tell me that, you know, whatever, whatever it might be.
Yeah.
I made that up. I just like, I'm trying to keep it rated G. But
yeah, I mean, and so the final point I wanted to talk about is, how is it productive, social media? So there, it's look, there's no shortage of examples of what goes wrong. A few days ago, we recorded an episode. You were off, but I interviewed Dave Kushner of Rolling Stone about Facebook and the dark side of the internet. And we spoke about, you know, now we're really just learning a lot of the underside of these tools we've loved, like Facebook. Everyone was sharing everything, and no one really thought of, you know, how the profit was being made. You were essentially dumping information and leaving the door open.
If the product is free.
Right.
If the service is free, then you're the product.
Right. And look, Twitter, it's easy to also mock. And I started this show by just reading a little bit of whatever, whatever the president's latest feed was, probably would be pretty controversial. But there are good parts of this. I mean, I think, look, our podcast for us is an example. It's a lot of people work on it, right? But compared to getting a radio show launched, say, 20 years ago, that was a lot of a much heavier lift. But here, through pretty standard technology, and Dan's right there too, you can get information and good conversation out there. And you can look, okay. Disclosure in politics is another area that's really important. Who's giving money to what? What does the data say? And just, this has created opportunities you think?
But this is very, and just to back up a step, this is highly dependent on market forces and the shape of the playing field. So we're very fortunate to be at a leading university where we have this large quantity of talented staff, people who can book guests, people who can produce it, make it sound, you know, okay. And take what I can do and like maximize that, and so that's good.
Yeah.
But we're not under market forces to say market pressure to maximize our audience. We like it when our audience is large, but the standard for a large audience is smaller for a podcast than for a talk show host. Like if I had a talk show, I can imagine, wow, I said something inflammatory, and my listenership doubled. Well, I should do that some more. And so there are these the rules of the game. Set the outcome. And so we happen to be in a place that rewards us to bring in a guest, talk for 40 minutes, and actually drill into an idea. So just to get back to that a little bit, one thing that's been in the news this week is Mark Zuckerberg showing up and attempting to explain Facebook to like an octogenarian senator. How do you make money? Through running ads? What's that? But these things are previously unregulated. If Twitter had comment moderation, it would become less hostile. If Facebook were under government regulation to protect people's privacy in certain ways, it would sharply limit the kinds of ways that messages could be targeted. And so just like any public utility where you can't, you can't discriminate, say, in the sale of electricity.
That's on the table, some kind of tighter regulation of these?
I think not right now, because basically nothing's going to happen between now and November on that front. But I think that there seems to be some energy.
Government regulation as opposed to.
Well, okay,
Twitter.
So I was talking to this.
Facebook is changing.
So this is a little unpodcasty, but okay, so I was over at CITP. I was getting to know the guys over there and the men and women over there.
Yeah.
And one possibility is local regulation. Is there going to be federal action to regulate Facebook? Well, maybe, maybe not. Is there going to be local? You can imagine that if one state moves and says, net neutrality must apply in the state of New Jersey or in the state of New York, you know, it's going to be a lot of work to only allow the net to be neutral there and not neutral other places. If California, which is a huge market, 1/10 of the United States' population, if California were to pass a law saying, okay, Facebook can't narrowcast ads of a political nature, or can't, or whatever it might be,
that would be so controversial. You don't think that would be controversial?
So you're saying that Facebook would file a lawsuit in federal court to get it overturned? It might be controversial, but if some agitated politician in the state of California says Facebook is selling your information, don't you hate that? We should have a law that.
Yeah.
Right. So you can, California has an initiative process. So I think that the federalism in this case might be helpful in the sense of creating local regulation that goes national. Because it's a lot of work to apply a law locally. This is what Nick Feimster and Ed Felton were telling me. It's a lot of work to implement a law locally and not apply it nationally. And so I think it's likely that these things are going to get regulated. We happen to be in this weird Wild West situation where Twitter is relatively unregulated. Facebook is basically unregulated.
Yeah.
Right?
At a minimum, consumer protection that applies in other industries.
Yeah, and I think that it,
well.
I think under the, as of this year, it's needless to say impossible that either the administration, the executive branch is kind of not doing very much in any domain actually. But like it's like, I mean, they're doing things, but like it's like positive regulation, no. And so the executive branch nor Congress, nothing's going to happen there. Maybe nothing's going to happen until, say, you know, after 2020.
Yeah.
Right.
But I want to take questions from the audience, but I spoke to, once I was, for, I had a dinner, a small dinner, and Chris Hughes was there, Facebook, and post-Facebook. And this came up, and it, this was before this, I mean, this was about a year and a half ago. He said if there was any effort to stop narrow, whatever, narrow casting ads or sending people news that they preferred, he thinks the users of Facebook, most users would hate, they would be up in arms about that. That most
they like narrow casted ads?
Yeah, that's what they want. That's exactly what they want. And he says it's a generational difference. And it was interesting conversation. That was, it was an informal discussion, but he was, and I've heard this from others, that this, I talked to my students the other day, and this came up last week here in my seminar, and we were talking about, do you mind that they're selling your information and everything? And, and one student said, no, who cares? They're like, so I get a watch ad because I searched watches. I don't really care. And I don't know. My point is I don't really know generationally.
And that was a tech executive who told you that?
Yes.
Okay. So I'm just like,
that was a student. That was one of my students here.
Because I'm just looking at, I'm going to my favorite websites as we're doing this. I'm like looking at the ads and I'm thinking, would I miss those ads? No, but I would not miss these ads.
I'm just right. But there could be
there's a Python ad that I. No,
when we talked to Kushner, when I talked to Kushner, he was the same way. He just says there's a lot of, it's a kind of generational difference. And I don't know politically what that means. Obviously, the weight of politics is still old rather than young. But I don't know if this will change. And I don't know how these kinds of stories about information selling, for example, will actually affect those kinds of preferences.
So
let's open it up for some questions. So we're willing to hear from you. Floor is open. Yes?
I'm curious, how has social media helped promote your podcast? Surely it has amplified your signal. I'm just curious.
Yeah. How has social media helped our podcast? We couldn't, I mean, it's essential to the podcast. You're more of a Twitter person than I am. I use Twitter and Facebook in the most boring way. Like, everyone says not to, like, you know, I'll be doing this today or I'll be doing that. But it has been a way to spread word of it. I mean, we have Princeton University, the Woodrow Wilson School puts this out. You guys tweet it. That's really important. Tweeting it out through the Woodrow Wilson feed, getting it on the website. But other than that,
that's a basic utility.
It's a very basic operation. It's us just tweeting this stuff out. And I think it's important. I mean, a lot of people I know respond when it goes out on one of these media.
Yeah, I think so. The basic thing is advertising. That's a little boring in the sense that it's just like a bulletin board that shows up in people's feeds. I mean, sometimes I'll use it when I do, not in the context of this podcast, but if I do a little bit of analysis that I like, and I have a graph that I want to show people. I have a pretty specialized set of followers who are kind of newsy, kind of neuroscience-y, kind of political, mostly political, I think. And if I put out a graph, then I'll put that out, and then I'll see whether it has legs. And there are occasions when I'm under the distinct impression that the graph that I put out has shaped things that people have said later. You know, on a much smaller scale than a real media person would do. But you know, like people follow me who do data analytics, and then maybe somebody who works for some media organization will start saying the same thing. So I think Twitter's a good medium for like putting out one idea that might grab people's attention. Like if I put a graph up of exactly what happened to the Hillary Clinton versus Donald Trump effective margin in the 2 or 3 days after Comey's announcement, you know, the week before the election, like if I put that graph out, like I guarantee you that goes like that took off.
But we couldn't do a podcast like this without social media. So again, back to 20 years ago, you need advertising. There was no way to get people to know about something, whereas even the Woodrow Wilson is an institution. It has kind of resources, and then us, we have no resources. But you combine that, and we got the word out. And that was all there was to it. We didn't have any you know, it wasn't like on television. There was an ad, go listen to Politics and Polls. So it has been kind of amazing that you can get word out that way and get each
Well, part of that is just cumulatively doing this. I mean, we're on number 87 now. So like part of it is just cumulating, you know, because originally when we started doing this podcast, Jillian said, would you like to do a podcast? And I said, sure, we'll do it, you know, and then we'll go through November and then Hillary's going to win and then I can go back to the other stuff. And, you know, that was literally.
I never thought that was going to happen. I was just going to convince you to keep going.
But that was literally, you remember, I said this to you. It's like, you know what? Like after the election, I'm going to get back.
No, that
to
is true. Yeah. We were planning to, or he was planning to stop, and I was planning just to compel him to do it.
Yeah, thanks.
But then the election. Yeah. Okay, yes. And then here. Yes.
You hear a lot of people invoking the need for critical thinking among social media users, especially in the sphere over regulation. And I've been skeptical of that. And at the Wilson School conference over the last weekend, someone invoked the concept of stranger danger campaigns, you know, for keeping children safe. And that's more of a cultural shift. So can you talk about the limits or opportunities of either critical thinking or just wholesale cultural shifts that might change the way people use social media and move away from some of the things that are fake or
how to introduce more critical thinking through social media. So one advantage, getting back to the business about structure dictating outcomes, one advantage of podcasts is the format is a natural, roomy format where one can talk for half an hour. And, you know, if somebody's exercising or driving their car or what have you, then that gives a little bit more room to think, the way that a good talk show that you're listening to on the radio might do. Another example of this would be our colleague Betsy Levy-Palak. She's done research that be interesting to have her on sometime to talk about how if you have a social network, if you seed it with ideas or instructions about how to reduce conflict, you can actually use the medium to spread ideas that are of a more constructive nature. I think the difficulty is how to scale those things up. So podcasts have the advantage that they seem to have somewhat naturally enhanced that kind of thing. I think it's really hard to harness major social media in the same way.
You know how else it's actually been interesting to watch is, so I publish a lot of op-eds, as you heard, and I write for CNN, I write every week, and The Atlantic a couple times a month, and then I've written in other outlets, but there are a lot of opportunities now. So we've talked a lot about the death of newspapers and all the struggles, but the amount of places you can publish thoughtful 800 word to 2,000 word pieces in my own career, which started in the mid 1990s, has increased multifold. And some of those outlets out there are not great, but I can tell I don't know what the, how much more there is now, but it's a lot. And I've had graduate students publishing good articles, and I think that's part of the social media that's really created good space for conversation. There's a lot of quality writing out there. I know there's a lot of bad writing too, but I actually think it's had a good effect. And a few newspapers no longer have a monopoly on the conversation. Even the ones that do have usually more space for writing. Like the Washington Post started this history blogish articles with historical perspective on things. It's really good. It gets out there. So that's another way, I think, in which this has worked pretty well. Yes,
right here.
Hi.
As someone that has a collection of over 200 trolls, can you talk a little
200
bit about
trolls?
Trolls, yes. I've definitely seen a difference in the tone on Facebook and even on Twitter. Can you talk a little bit about any experiences that you've had on your social media?
I've had tons of terrible experiences. I have them weekly. So, I don't know. I mean, for me, it's become a regular part of my life. I have been, you know, blasted on Twitter. That's a normal thing. You know, you get good comments, and then you get random comments from people when you say something they don't like. It does often happen once you're on television, you come off. But I've written things that can evoke a pretty fierce response, and I can't always predict. I mean, I'm proud that I get attacked by the left and the right. That I like that. But it can be very intense when you're in the middle of one of these. And I have been in the middle of these. And then the other part is obviously I always have lots of phone calls here at Princeton from listeners or viewers who didn't like what I said. So meaning information is easy to access online. And that is something we live with. I've also had, though, great experiences. It isn't all the yelling and screaming at me. I've been able to kind of reach all sorts of people from high politics to pop culture through things I put out there, and that's great. So it's hard, though. I always tell students, I always have students who want to do this. You know, should I start writing op-eds? And I'm always hesitant, not just because of tenure issues, but you have to have thick skin if you're going to enter this world. And you have to be ready for this, and you have to accept it, and you can't just knee-jerk engage angrily.
I have,
and
yeah.
So that's where I am. I've had a lot. I can give you specific stories, but I'll let Sam talk.
I have rules.
Yeah.
If I write for a medium like the New York Times or someplace else where I'm writing a column, there's a comment thread that goes with that column. I never read that,
yeah,
ever.
I don't read it.
Like once a friend of mine said, did you see what they were saying to you in that thread? I said, no.
Yeah.
Like I literally never read the comments.
Really?
Never, at all.
I don't either.
On Twitter, if I send something out and like there's, occasionally I'll dip into like what people reply, like maybe once every month or so I'll look, and I'm always sorry that I did that. Like I do not read replies to things that I tweet at. I just don't. And I realize this is very anti-social media. But my feeling about it is, you know what, by social media standards, I've got kind of a moderate amount of number of followers. It's like about 35,000. So, you know, out of 35,000, there might be 100 of them who hate me for various reasons. Like, do I really want to listen to them? And I think I don't. And I know that's terrible, but one thing that's nice about the podcast is that there's no comment thread on a podcast. It's kind of nice, actually.
Now, I'm curious about searching for feedback? Or who?
That kind of feedback's often not useful.
I like curated feedback. Like, if Julian gives me feedback, that's great. If a guest gives me feedback, that's great. But, like rando feedback, that's terrible. Yuck.
Right.
Yeah.
No, we didn't have these conversations, and we had only encountered each other at a few events, kind of, dinners and stuff, and it was that talk we did that Elizabeth talked about earlier that launched it. And so that's also amazing. We didn't really test it out or anything. We just started doing the whole thing, and it organically took off.
I have occasionally had that kind of experience with it, like a two-person conversation when team teaching with some people, where if I've done a really good job, where my colleague and I have done a good job of picking each other as co-instructors, then there is that synergy that can develop. But in this case, we didn't know at the beginning, and it took a while to figure out how to, shape the conversation.
I mean, my thought was that Sam, in his political role, deals with things through statistics and math, and I tend to look at things historically and qualitative arguments, and that's it's a tension, or it can complement each other, that you see in a lot of the media these days. You know, the upshot versus whoever's reporting on the front page. So, it'd be interesting to bring together, and he's pretty funny. So he's an interesting combo, so I thought that would be good as well.
Yeah, no, it is true that we have complementary ways, although you are often the one who brings up polling data.
That's true.
And I think I also, in addition to the data science, I often like to bring in various kinds of academic research from both natural sciences and social sciences.
Yeah.
I feel like there's stuff that can be useful there that can shape things from that end. So it's good that we come in with different kinds of expertise, but with a common interest.
You've had a lot of guests on the show who've retweeted.
Yes.
Great. Who has been your favorite guest that you've both interviewed of the 87?
Our favorite guest of the 87.
Well, for me, the Drive-By Truckers was great because I love the band. And it was also on a day, I had them come to speak here at Princeton and to sing. It was a horrible blizzard. And they were already here, so they called me the night before. So somehow we were going to have to make the whole day work. So I was just happy to interview them. I thought it was interesting. I thought they were incredibly smart and had these kind of arguments about politics in their region that were terrific. Sam got in this whole discussion with them using Google data.
I used Google Correlate and showed them where they were popular.
They love this.
Yeah, that almost stopped the podcast because they wanted to.
Right, no, they liked it. So that was a great conversation. It was also great that we could pull it off. I remember Dan had to run it through remote, and it was the whole day. But that was terrific. General Petraeus was really interesting, I thought, to have a figure of that stature. And this was shortly after the I can't remember if it was in the transition or after the new presidency started, but it was interesting to hear his thoughts on foreign policy. So, look, there's many. I mean, we've had really great guests, and I don't want to, I could name all of them, but the drive-by truckers, Patterson, Hood, and Mike Cooley, I can't top that, I don't think.
I think my favorite guests have been ones where there was something that I just really had not thought of at all. And so, like, Rebecca Traister from New York Magazine was in that category. There have been a few others who've really kind of made me think in ways that I had not been expecting. Linda Gordon, the historian, looking at on the KKK in the 1930s and how big they got as a civic organization, which had not occurred to me that the KKK was like next to the Rotarians and the suffragettes, and like all these civic organizations were in this ferment. And so I think that for me, my favorite guests are the ones, actually the historians, honestly, are the ones that I've liked the most. Richard White, writing about the Gilded Age, because there are these echoes of that time that are present in our time, where the KKK was a legitimate social movement in the 1920s, or where there was this time of instability and corruption in the late 19th century. And talking to those people, hearing from those scholars, and just really having room to talk about their ideas, that's been a real education
for me. And that was one of the hopes of the show, was to bring interesting people in academia who might not even be writing in a way that's quote-unquote popular, but are working on topics that are really relevant to what's going on today, and giving them a forum to talk about their books or articles. I think we've done pretty well with that, but it's always like one of the most popular early ones with this political scientist Sam mentioned, Eric Schickler of Berkeley, who is not, he's
not a media
guy. He's a technical guy, and it was very popular because it was just a great conversation on labor, race, the New Deal coalition, the whole thing. So that has always been an ambition of ours. Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing. Everyone in politics who talks about this stuff is usually using the last technology. Like, even we're talking about Twitter, but I know, my kids don't use Twitter at all. And even Instagram isn't used. It's like Snapchat is the thing. Probably that's dated. So I do think, in a serious question, in terms of political engagement and mobilization, you need consultants who aren't like talking about Facebook and what it can do right now, when not a single person under 30 is on Facebook.
I think the general rule is that, my feeling about that is that the general rule about social media is that it amplifies tendencies that are there. And so if I go to an event where there are people who have mobilized because they care a lot about a thing, then that's the relationship building where voter registration forms get handed out or people care about a thing. And social media amplifies it. So it's the thing that we use to measure the sentiment. But I wouldn't necessarily say that it's the thing that caused the mobilization in the first place. So I think that one should not undervalue the importance of actual meet space, eye to eye, mobilizing at whatever, the March for Science.
Political scientists still say they find that door-to-door, face-to-face communication is still the best way to get people to vote.
Yep.
At least a few years ago that. We have one more question. Yep. Yeah.
Where we were all horrified and deeply emotionally concerned by Milei, and so forth. Here in the media, this is the first war that was televised and came into our room every day. Now, we're kind of detached. I mean, we see 200 people killed in Syria, I don't know, just for me, it doesn't bring that same emotion. And I'm wondering whether the acceleration that you mentioned, that we don't have time to think about it now. Today, is that the same thing going to happen to the current social media, that after a while we just won't give it in?
So you think that with easy access to information, we become desensitized to international violence?
For a while, and then we start detaching ourselves.
One difficulty is adapting to the new media. Like, we're not desensitized to the president denying payoffs to a porn star. Just stop and do a thought experiment and think about like Jimmy Carter having to deny that. Like, it's just like times, like there's this weird desensitization.
He did have lust in his heart.
Yeah, and he kept it there. And so
5 years ago,
I think that is that's a really interesting point. And the shock and awe in some ways during the 1960s, when especially the late 60s, when the TV reporters started to really bring the coverage of war to us, was incredibly powerful. And then over time, various things happen. Some of that coverage goes away, and we cover it differently, kind of like Operation Desert Storm, almost video game coverage. But part of it is there was people were desensitized. You can still see horrific images, but I think they go right by the wayside. There's probably going to be something to that with the current media, where now we're all worked up about it, but I'm sure a similar process will happen. So I think that is a cycle that will probably play out. So thanks to everyone for joining us today. It's been great to do this live. And once again, for everyone listening, you can find us on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Spotify. And thanks for joining us. We'll be back soon on Politics and Polls.
Bye, everybody.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series produced by WooCast. This podcast is intended to be informational only and does not reflect nor represent the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.